Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap.
Can you honestly tell me that you forgot? Forgot the magnetism of Robin Zander or the charisma of Rick Nielsen?
That's kid stuff.
Kid stuff? Well, how about the tunes? I want you to want me. The dream police. Da, 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 da. Your mama's all right. Your daddy's all right. But just seem a little bit weak.
Surrender. Surrender.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We are here in the Vinegaroon Saloon. I am joined by Power Pop T.
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen.
And fresh back from Colorado, we have Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
I didn't bring the cool weather with me, did I?
You cut me off, Doug. You didn't let me finish my hello there, ladies and gentlemen. Are you ready to rock, is what I was going to add, but that's okay. In homage.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I like that. We should, maybe that could be our tagline. Well, there goes the momentum.
Sorry about that.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a listener's pick. It is the third album by the band Cheap Trick, who's not British. Yeah.
They're Illinoisans.
They're Illinoisans.
Illinois.
Don't say Illinois, or they'll say, there's no noise in Illinois. Or anyway, I said that wrong. This is a 1978 pick, and as I said earlier, this is a listener's pick. There were quite a few people that wanted to hear Cheap Trick. This is the 1978 album Heaven Tonight.
Heaven Tonight. Yep.
And we hope that this listening experience will be heaven for you. Now, I've got a couple of questions for you guys, as I always do.
All right. Mm-hmm.
This album was not picked by one of us. Nope. But if one of us had picked it, who would have picked it first?
It would have been Tony.
Why do you say that, Jonathan J. Rowe?
It's got so much of what Tony enjoys about music. He likes power pop, and this is definitely leans in that direction. Although I wouldn't call it a power pop album.
See, I knew there was a very first checkbox of contention. I knew there'd be a discussion about whether or not Cheap Trick was power pop or not.
Tony brought his bingo card today. There was another kind of music that Tony liked even before power pop.
That's true. It was metal.
Uh-huh. And there's elements of that here.
I think the producer produces a lot of metal albums.
Yeah, yeah, but he also, before he got into producing a bunch of metal guys, he was an air guy for Epic. So he brought over, I think he brought Boston to the label.
Yes,
and REO Speedwagon, not really a metal standard bearer, REO Speedwagon.
But very sensitive and good for slow dances. Who produced this album?
Fellow by the name of Tom Werman.
Wow, the way you pulled that from the top of your head, Dave.
Well, and he's not new to the band because he produced the album before this one and the album after this. What's interesting, though, about him producing this album tonight is that this is hindsight. They didn't say it at the time, but when In Color, their second album, was released, since then they've complained about the production values of it, yet they use this guy two other times, which is kind of an odd thing.
That is an odd thing. Decision, yeah.
Well, this is a critically well-reviewed album for the most part.
Yeah.
Some people consider it their best. And I've got some questions for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I have this question. What do Cheap Trick have in common with Bob Seger, Peter Frampton, and the Allman Brothers?
They make better live albums than they do studio albums.
Well, that's not how I was going to say it, but that's right on target. The breakthrough for all of those bands
was
a live album.
Yeah.
Of course, we have Frampton Comes Alive, which sold 16 million, I think. Live album.
Yeah.
And Live from the Fillmore East by the Allman Brothers, mm-hmm. which is, some people say, the best live album of all time.
They'd be wrong. Wake up, mama. Turn your lamp down low.
Wake up, mama. Turn your lamp down low. You got no nerve.
Live at Leeds is the best live album of all time.
That's okay. Good. Yeah.
Well, we'll correct all those critics who've studied rock and roll their whole life. And of course, Bob Seger had that. What is it? It's the one that bust him out right before Stranger in Town and Night Moves came out. So, Live at Budokan is Cheap Trick's album, and it's a monster. And if you don't have that record, my suggestion to you is to stop this podcast right now, go to the bathroom, look at yourself in the mirror, and say, why do I hate my own guts?
The interesting thing about that album is the record company was just going to release it in Japan, and people started importing it, paying import prices to get it in the States. That's how much they wanted to hear it.
Yeah, it was
it's such a strange story, but that broke this band like nothing else. And I remember, maybe it was high school, that was what you heard when you heard Cheap Trick. It was the live album from Budokan.
You did.
Which is in Tokyo, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. And it's a fantastic live album. It should be in everyone's collection. We're going to have trouble not returning to that topic some tonight.
Yeah. But a couple of things. I slightly disagree with JM in that I think there are certain songs that live versions of them on that album are better. And that album is remarkable. I'm not going to disagree with that. But I don't think the way you said that sort of disparaged their studio output. And I think they're very good in the studio as well.
Yeah. I don't know that I share that sentiment. I think that they are good musicians, but I'll be honest, it is really difficult for me to get through a whole Cheap Trick album from song to song, except for Live at Budokan.
It's difficult for me not to listen to the first three Cheap Trick albums, four maybe, but the first three more than once when I put them on, so...
Well,
we're all here. Different colors to this collage that we call This Is Vinyl.
Yeah.
We're going to arm wrestle pretty soon, JM.
Yeah, well, this kind of goes, you know, the main songwriter is Rick Nielsen. Is that his name? How you pronounce his name?
Rick Nielsen.
We should say that he was in Ozzy and Harriet's before this.
Is that right?
Yeah, you didn't know that?
No, I didn't.
He wasn't.
Well, that was Ricky.
That was Ricky Nielsen. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but he's the main songwriter. It always seems, this album is no exception. When he's firing on all cylinders, he writes fantastic songs like Surrender, like I Want You to Want Me. But a lot of times it seems to me like his songs are kind of cobbled together from ideas of, and he just kind of messes them together and says, okay, here's a song.
So I think that's a good point to go back to something I was going to say when you guys were talking about the whether or not that what kind of music is this? Is this power pop? Is this metal? Is this hard rock?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about Cheap Trick is they've always sort of straddled that line.
Yeah.
And I think
what, I think they're straddling a lot more than that line.
They are, but I think what you're talking about, JM, is that particular... There are songs where you hear, oh, this sounds like 70s hard rock.
Yeah.
And then the chorus kicks in, and we'll talk about a couple of them on this. Your chorus kicks in, you're like, oh, that's a power pop song.
Exactly.
And and I think that's what makes this band, for me, it makes them interesting, because it's you don't know which direction you're going to go in, and it always draw. If there's a part of the song that I feel is a little... maybe not my cup of tea, there'll be a hook someplace.
Yeah, that's kind of...
I'll go, oh, wow, this is great.
That's right. And a lot of the songs are like more than one song.
Mm-hmm. Right, and yeah. It's like a Simpsons episode. It's the Simpsons always start in one place, and then that beginning has absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the, the plot of the story of the show.
I didn't know that. Of course, not all of us spent our time as profitably as you have. But... the thing I would say about Cheap Trick, I have two observations. That one is, they're a good band, but when they're live, they're a great band.
Yeah.
When they're live, it's a different animal. And I'm a little prejudiced. I saw them when I was in eighth grade.
Oh, wow.
It was one of the first shows I ever saw.
Oh, wow.
And they opened for Boston.
Oh, wow. Great.
That made them look even better, because... yeah. Boston is a, we're going to stand here and play our instruments band. And Cheap Trick, they had...
bouncing all over the place.
They had Rick out there with a six-neck guitar and all changing clothes all the time. And he's really a pick dispenser.
Yeah.
He wants to make sure everybody in the first 25 rows gets a pick. But he was a showman. And, of course, they did a number of Beatles numbers, and they can really do the Beatles. And that was a lot of fun. But there's so much energy.
They had a residency in Las Vegas where they did nothing but Beatles songs.
I believe it.
And then they have a live album that is Sgt. Pepper's, where they redid Sgt. Pepper's.
Yeah, they would go. You would go and you would hear.
That would be the one I choose for them to redo.
Yeah.
That's not...
that, what do you think?
They needed help. They could do help.
Yeah, they could do help.
But the other thing about this band is... It's not a cerebral band at all. It's 100%. This is just fun.
Yep.
And if you're in the stage where you're going, oh, I'm so deep, I just can't, go away. You're not going to like it. Go find something miserable to listen to. And this is just fun.
And I'm one of those people. I stopped listening to them for a while because I thought, oh, this is too... oh, I like Surrender. That's a good song. But everything else about them, yeah.
Well, and when they try to be deep...
like the flame.
It doesn't always work.
Yeah.
It's a little rough. It's a little rough.
And I think that's when we need to think of what John Prime would say in a situation like this.
What's that?
You are what you are, and you ain't what you ain't. And when, like so many other bands, when Cheap Trick is doing what they do, they're fantastic.
They are so, and I've seen them probably, I have no idea why I've seen them this many times. I've seen them probably five times. And the first time that I saw them, they were at their nadir. It was mid-80s. And I went and saw him at this small club in San Antonio. I remember this show so well because there was this guy that opened for him who I guess they were trying to make into like the next Jimi Hendrix or something. And he was this big old, like, look like a Samoan guy. And he was trying to do all these guitar effects and everything. He went by the name Dumbo. And then after that, I mean, you could just tell Cheap Trick was just not having a very good time, because when they got on stage, Robin Zander was wearing dark sunglasses, an overcoat, and a G-string. And he just stood there the whole time singing. Rick Nelson was just yelling stuff into the audience the whole time. It was pretty obvious he wasn't having a very good time.
That was the first time you saw them?
That was the first time I saw him. Then after that, I kept seeing them at... it seemed like every festival that I would go to had Cheap Trick as the headline.
Well, they are a hard-working band.
They are. They are.
They're always on the road.
Well, and I want to go back to your first experience, Doug, because I find it fascinating. And I think this is, again, them straddling these various lines. When you look at the bands they played with, It's Boston, Rush, Kiss. Yeah. I mean, it's weird.
Yeah.
And I think that's why in the sort of listening consciousness of people who aren't super hardcore Cheap Trick fans, they don't think of them on the poppy side of stuff. They think of a more of a hard rock band because of that particular, and they can play that stuff, but because of that association with, they may have gone to a Kiss show and seen Cheap Trick open for them, or they went to see Boston and saw Cheap Trick open for them.
I never thought of Cheap Trick as hard rock anything until we started doing a drill down on this. I have always thought of them as a Beatlesque pop band.
Me too.
And But
they're not. His guitar playing is not Beatles.
George Harrison.
Yeah, it's definitely not. There is not a whole lot of arpeggios, or that he is a.
I don't think. Beatlesque bands don't strap on six neck guitars and.
Well, he's a joker. Uh-huh. It's hard to find an interview with him that's really worth listening to, because he's clowning around so much.
Well,
and that's Rick Nielsen.
And that's what has made sort of finding out some of the history of this band difficult for the podcast, because there's a lot of contradictions. There's a lot of, we don't take ourselves very seriously.
Yeah.
The one guy who's the archivist for the band, the unofficial / official archivist for the band, Bunny Carlos, he's kind of the same way. He's a jokester.
Yeah. You know? Yeah,
and he's
not with the band anymore.
Well, he doesn't play with them live, but I think he's got some sort of arrangement where I'm not really sure what the arrangement is. He sued them at one point.
Yeah, there's some sort of, like, he still gets to be a member of Cheap Trick. He just can't play on any.
He's anything. Yeah. He helps with the decisions. Like, he's a decision maker.
Right.
But I don't think he and Robin Zander have spoken.
Yeah.
In
a long time.
That's sad.
Yeah. I don't like getting to that aspect of stuff. No, so I don't.
We like it where everybody's happy.
But he is, like, if you ever see him, he's like just back there keeping time, smoking cigarettes. And he looks like he's an accountant back there when he's playing. And with his
He needs a monocle.
You know, he taught himself how to play drums
because
he's left-handed, and he couldn't. And when he was playing, he got so frustrated, he just said, "Screw it," and taught himself.
He taught himself a unique sounding drumming method.
Uh huh.
Lots of rapid runs.
Yeah,
I was thinking about, that's the only lead instrument on this album. Most of the songs.
Yeah, he's kind of got that Keith Moon style.
Loosey-goosey.
Yeah.
Loud and loosey-goosey.
Loud.
Well, I want to deviate from what we normally do here for just a second and take advantage of the fact that y'all are both potomologists and go into that for a minute. What?
We're what?
Potomologists. People who study rivers.
Oh.
So we have this river called Cheap Trick.
Uh-huh.
I want to discover its tributaries, and I want to go one at a time, one tributary at a time between the two of y'all, and find out what y'all think. I want to start with Jonathan J.M. Rowe. What tributary pours into the river known as Cheap Trick?
Wow, that's a tough one. Other than the Beatles.
Nobody gets to say the Beatles. I forgot that part.
I can't say the Beatles.
Oh, I've got.
Okay, some. We're going to go to T since Jonathan's going,
The Jeff Beck Group.
Would you like to go in?
Well, the Yardbirds and Jeff Beck, they were, all of these guys were huge, huge, huge Jeff Beck Yardbirds fans.
Is that right?
Yeah, in fact, I don't want to slide. I always slide into connections, but they, when the Yardbirds came to Illinois and played, before the guys were ever in a band, they were all in the crowd to see it. In fact, Bunny Carlos ended up getting backstage in between. They played two sets. The Yardbirds played two sets. He went backstage between two sets and spoke with Beck and asked him to explain feedback to him. But the cool thing is that when the Jeff Beck Group was playing someplace, Rick Nielsen was watching the Jeff Beck Group in 68, and he was zeroed in on Jeff Beck's equipment. And he saw his guitar tech break his guitar. So he wrote him a note, the guitar tech a note, and said, "Hey, I know you don't know me, but I saw what happened. I collect guitars." Even back then, he was collecting guitars. He goes, "Let me know, let me know what I can do." And 2 weeks later, Jeff Beck reaches out to him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Nielsen ends up flying to Philly, brings five guitars with him. I forget which guitar he ended up selling him, but it was one that would go for $500,000 today.
Yeah, he's got some really good guitars.
But yeah, Jeff Beck is a huge, huge influence on him.
Okay. Wow.
I got one. The Naz or Todd Rundgren. Mm-hmm. I can see that really
well.
That kind of chunky guitar and those voices that are what I call helium voices.
Do you guys not know the connection to the Naz?
No.
Well, I'm kind of getting into history here, but Nielsen and Peterson both played in a band that called themselves the Naz for a while.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they had two of the guys from the band when Todd Rundgren left. They hooked up with them and played in Philly as the Naz, and then their band, Fuse. These two guys were in that. So they actually, depending on where they were playing, they would either play as the Naz or...
They should have become the Fuseness.
The Fuseness?
The Fuseness.
Well, okay, so that's a good one.
Yeah. One other one, I guess the Raspberries. I could kind of see a little bit of the Raspberries.
Well, I think any of that, the Raspberries definitely, any of that sort of Americanized Beatles 70s pop stuff. I mean, I'm not going to say Big Star because they probably didn't know who the heck Big Star was. I think Kiss is an influence on this band.
Oh, yeah.
And the parents.
I can see that.
Yeah. Oh geez, easy one. The Move in ELO.
Okay, that's okay. For sure.
Yeah.
And while we're on that. Here we have something that I think is a very ELO-lian bit of Cheap Trick.
That's one of my favorite songs. But
he really sings well.
He is a very, very good singer. He's one of the most underrated singers,
He may be outdoing Jeff Lynne on that.
Yeah. It's funny because I that's definitely Jeff Lynne there. But at this stage, the stage we're talking about now, they're much more into the Roy Wood aspect of all that.
Well, and he's on here. Yeah. So
if you told me that was Jeff Lynne playing guitar on that song, I would have.
I think there's a couple of eel moments on Heaven Tonight as well.
There are.
Yeah.
That's what got me started on the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And we'll hear a couple of them. The other one that I'm not very confident about because I don't listen to the band very much is AC/DC. But I hear AC/DC stuff on a couple of songs.
There's an elements there from whatever
the guitar
was getting
sound.
Both of those bands going.
Both have really attractive power chords and come up with nice little numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
I was fascinated by the fact that Cheap Trick, In Color, and Heaven Tonight all came out within...
Yeah.
A year and a half of each other.
Yeah.
It's like the late 60s when the...
It's like Creedence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get those three albums in 1 year.
He's a fascinating guitarist to me. I love watching him play live. He's just so... It looks like it's so effortless for him to be doing all that stuff.
That's what I was about to say. It looks like they're lip syncing.
Yeah.
Because he does... But I saw him address that. He goes, people always say that. And I go, do you know how many times I've played these songs?
He started out as a drummer.
Yeah.
He was a drummer in his first band and evidently was frustrated by the fact that he kept having to get out from behind the kit and tell the guitarist how to tune his guitar. He said, I didn't know how to read music or anything, but I could tell a bad note from a good note. So I would go out there and teach him how to, because his dad was...
That takes us back to...
Oh, yeah. His dad owned a music store.
I guess the music store
in the area.
In Rockford. Well, speaking of Rockford tea, do we want to go through the history of these nice young American men that I always thought were British?
I mean, there's not a whole lot. And I think probably the easiest way to do this is just talk briefly about early moments of each of the guys in the band and then kind of try to figure out how to weave them together. So I'll start with the most obvious, which is Rick Nielsen. He was born in Elmhurst, which is a suburb of Chicago, in 1948, and his parents were both opera singers. In fact, his dad directed symphonies, choirs, and recorded several albums. So his dad was a kind of a big deal in that scene. And I moved from Elmhurst to Rockford. And then when Nielsen was in his teens, his family started a record store, the Ralph Nielsen House of Music, which was a pretty big deal. Uh-huh. And he worked there off and on, and he learned how to play all sorts of stuff. He was the first clarinet chair in seventh grade of his junior high. Huh. He was eventually expelled because he said something to the teacher that wasn't very expelled from the band, not from school.
Yeah, school.
Yeah. What's funny about that story is in 2012, the current principal reinstated him back into the band as a gesture. But when he was 13, his first band was called the Phaetons. And that's when we talked about it. He was a drummer at that point. His parents loved the fact that they were always supportive of him. They loved the fact that he was in that. Yeah. Their garage was the place where the bands would practice. The Phaetons evidently were so loud that it got a warning letter from the state attorney's office complaining about the noise, because a neighbor complained about the noise. So I mentioned how he switched to guitar. So we'll stop there and move on to Bunny Carlos, because I think he's kind of the next step. He's born in Rockford in 1951, and his name, he was not born Bunny Carlos. He was born Brad Carlson.
If they'd name you Bunny, that's so you'll grow up to be tough.
Well, he said that, you know, just a brief aside about his name. Tom Peterson started calling him Bunny when they were playing together. And he said, you know, I need a professional name here. And he looked around. He said, okay, we've got a Nielsen. We've got a Peterson. I'm Carlson. We're going to sound like a bunch of Swedes if I don't figure something out. So he changed it to Carlos. Anyway, he also grew up in a musical family. His mother played piano since she was four, and she continued to play various places until she died at 87 in 2012. And jeez, his brothers and sisters were the ones that kind of gave him the intro into rock and roll. And of course, the big moment of clarity was seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, right?
Yeah.
That's a connection.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Either Elvis or the Beatles.
His mom bought him his first drum set from, of all places, Ralph Nielsen House of Music. So there you go. He was in several local Rockford bands. In 1966, he was drumming for a band called the Pagans. They actually had a local hit on Chicago radio with a cover of Good Day Sunshine by the Beatles. And the B-side was I Can Only Give You Everything by them. So,
Really?
Yep.
Cool.
It sold 15,000 copies, and they were the local celebrities. And then in 69, the Pagans broke up, and he joined another local band called Probe and the Lost Souls, which later became a band called Albatross. Now I'm going to switch over to Tom Peterson real quick. He was born in 1950 as Thomas John Peterson with one S instead of two. I'm not really sure why he added the S.
Huh, yeah.
Somebody can tell us that.
Very deep and meaningful.
He was also born in Rockford. He started playing in bands. He was a rhythm guitarist, and he was fairly good. His first real band was a band called the Bullweevils. Any guess why they were called the Bullweevils?
Because they played a lot of Chuck.
They ate Berry. Cotton.
No, they played a lot of Beatles covers. So Bullweevil Beatles. That's the thing.
In cotton country, that's not very funny. I bet Buddy Holly wouldn't think that was funny.
No. And then they had some regional success too, and they actually recorded a couple of tunes for a label out of Wisconsin called Leaf Records. Yeah. Due to some personnel changes, mainly because of military service or avoiding military service, the Bullweevils morphed into a band called Toast and Jam, three words, which later became Toast and Jam, two words. And then they played primarily rhythm and blues and traditional blues stuff. There's a battle of the bands at some point where Toast and Jam played in a lineup or in a battle, I guess, with another band called the Grim Reapers, which was Rick Nielsen's band after the Phaetons had kind of dissolved. And then what's interesting about that, and this is a connection, so we'll get into connections. They got a management deal. Toast and Jam got a management deal because of that battle of bands with a guy named Ken Adamami. Do you know who he is?
No.
Are we ready to do connections on that launch?
Sure. Yeah.
Sights and sounds. This is Vinyl Touch. We're going to take it all down to memory lane.
We're all going to go live on the boat.
So Ken Adamani is their man. At this point, he's managing every sort of aspect including when Cheap Trick gets signed and everything. But he was in a band called the Night Trains. Do you guys remember us talking about a band called the Night Trains? Yes. Think about Wisconsin Night Trains.
Oh.
Steve Miller.
Oh.
He was the keyboardist for a band with Steve Miller that Steve Miller was in. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, there's a connection.
There is a connection.
So, T takes the lead, Jonathan J. M. Rowe.
I really don't have one. I think the best I can do is the keyboardist on this album, who plays with a lot of the early albums by Cheap Trick, is a guy named Jai Winding.
Mm-hmm.
He has played with Jackson Browne. He's played with a lot of people.
He played on an album we talked about, the Warren Zevon album.
That's right. Played with Warren Zevon. Yeah.
How about Robert Zimmerman, otherwise known as Bobby Dylan?
I don't know. What's the connection there?
Well, we have a lyrics connection.
Oh, we do have a lyrics connection. That's right. There's a line from All on the Watchtower.
Many here among us.
Yeah.
Huh.
So yeah. We'll get to that later. You can tell I didn't have very many good ones.
I've got another one, sort of loosey-goosey. It's kind of a two-parter. Before they got signed, they actually recorded some demos at Ardent Studios in Memphis.
Oh.
Do you remember why we talked about Ardent, obviously?
Because of Big Star.
Big Star.
Yep.
And then the two-parter of that is when that 70s show was on the television, Cheap Trick did the cover of In the Street, which is on Number One Record, which is the record we talked about. Cheap Trick adds at the end of their version of it, "We're all right," as a nod to
Surrender.
I think it's a nod to Surrender, but also because I never thought about this until we were doing this podcast. That show is kind of a what Surrender is about in a lot of ways.
It is.
So anyway,
I didn't think about that. In Record Planet, we've been to Record Planet before. I can't remember with exactly whom we were there with, but that's the recording studio in L.A.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And also, they were in Sound City, which I'm sure we've been there before.
Oh, yeah.
But And then we have a Rotten Wood connection between the early days of ELO and his song on this record.
Yeah, Roy Wood.
And did I say Ron Wood?
You said, it's hard not to.
Well, there is a Ron Wood connection because when Nielsen walked into the room to with the guitars, Ron Wood was evidently sitting there drinking tea out of an antique tea set he just purchased. So.
I guess one kind of tenuous connection is George Martin. We've talked about him. We talked about the Beatles. He produced the album All Shook Up, I believe.
Todd Rundgren produced one of their albums as well.
Yeah, Todd Rundgren. That's the other one I was going to say.
He
Todd
always
Rundgren.
Pops up.
It's impossible. I think if you're a band long enough,
Todd Rundgren shows up at
the studio. Todd Rundgren's going to show up at some point.
I'm just fascinated by the fact that they're managed by a guy who was playing in a band that Steve Miller was in Wisconsin. Just thinking about that connection is something I would have never known about if I wasn't doing this podcast.
Yeah. Well, it's those things that makes our lives so deep.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to this riveting history as we move through these different bands that eventually become our band.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm gonna move on from I was talking about Tom Peterson, right?
Yeah.
So I'm gonna move on from him and just briefly talk about Robin Zander. So he was born in Beloit, Wisconsin, in 1953. He moved to Loves Park, Illinois, when he was 8, and by 12, he's a pretty decent guitar player. His first band was a band called the Destinations. It was 3 13-year-old guitarists, of which Zander was one of them, and a 10-year-old drummer.
Yeah,
and they were out playing on someone's porch, and this guy drove by and heard them and asked if they wanted to play the annual Roscoe Fall Festival. So they actually played the 57th annual Roscoe Fall Festival, and they were billed as the youngest and loudest band in Rockford. The next band he was in, or one of the next bands he was in, was a psychedelic band called Purple Haze. Go into your comment about purple being the color.
Much more psychedelic than blue.
Yeah, and then they later changed their name to Butterscotch Sunday.
I like Purple Haze better. But
I don't like either one of them.
Purple Haze is famous for some other musician. Yeah, I can't think of who it is right now.
Me either.
Yeah, who would that be?
These guys, how'd these guys hook up? Well, Peterson and Nielsen have the longest history together. They were in a bunch of bands together before Cheap Trick. I talked about the Battle of Bands where the Grim Reapers and Toast and Jam fought it out. Well, sometime in 67, the Grim Reapers and Toast and Jam merged. And there's some memory of Peterson playing in the Grim Reapers, but I couldn't find any sort of verification of that.
Yeah.
But the new band is called Fuse, and it's essentially two guys, including Rick Nielsen from the Grim Reapers, and three guys, including Tom Peterson from Toast and Jam, and they're managed by Ken Adamany, as I said. Going back to Robin Zander real quick, around this time, he and Bunny Carlos were playing together. Bunny Carlos was attending Rock Valley College to avoid the draft. Zander was still in high school, and they would get together and play in a band called Tunes from time to time. Switching back to Fuse, Fuse ends up recording a single for Smack Records in 1969. They're signed by Epic, and they record their self-titled debut pretty quickly after that. It's released in 1970, and as so many times we talk about this stuff, it goes nowhere. It's a flop. The band shortly just kind of disbands after that. A song called Show Me by
Man, that Fuse. Show sounds so much like Deep Purple right there.
Doesn't sound like it.
Doesn't
I
sound
like
Cheap Trick though. No, doesn't it?
Like, I thought he was gonna drums say, oh, move over, Rover, let Jimmy take over. I liked it. It does sound like somebody sped up something there.
Well, and so yeah, that was the album off of the album that didn't go anywhere. Around that same time, Robin Zander hooks up with a piano player and they form a folk group called Zander and Kent. And they get this residency at this place called the Piccadilly Pub in the Wisconsin Dells for 3 summers. And during the off times, he would still get together with Bunny Carlos and they'd play from time to time. So after the Fuse kind of dissolves or has their issue, doesn't
it's
dissolve.
It's defused.
Yeah, they have their issue with their album going nowhere. There's a bit of a lineup change. So Peterson and Nielsen hook up with Robert Stuckey Antoni, who's the vocalist for the Nazz, and Tom Mooney, who is the drummer for the Nazz. And because the Nazz was based in Philly, the two of them move out to Philadelphia. And they, like I said, they use both names from time to time. That's weird how all this stuff gets connected. Tom Mooney ends up leaving to join Bob Welch's band Paris.
Oh, really?
And so they need a drummer. And who do they call on?
Bunny Carlos.
Bunny Carlos. So Bunny Carlos goes out there and they change their name to Sick Man of Europe, which is actually a Cheap Trick song later on. But
well, yeah. Who is the Sick Man of Europe? Don't remember this from World
Shakespeare?
War One.
Oh.
Ottoman Empire.
I did not know that.
Yeah. That's the kind of stuff that chicks listen to this show for.
Sounds better than Turkey.
So in 73, Nielsen, Peterson, and Carlos end up going back to Rockford. For some reason, when they continue in Rockford, Peterson's not on bass anymore. They have this guy named Rick, I'm going to mangle his name, Zuleg Zeluga on bass, and this guy named Randy Zeno Hogan on vocals. Because club owners hated that name, Sick Man of Europe, they called themselves the Reapers for a while. They started playing around in clubs again, and then they came up with the name Cheap Trick. Do you guys know the story behind that? Because there's 3 different stories.
I don't know it, no.
Well, let's learn all 3 of them.
I'm just going to talk about the 2 main ones. The first one is that after seeing a Slade concert, Rick Nielsen goes, they're using all the Cheap Tricks in the book up there. And so they came up with that name. But Bunny Carlos says they were sitting around in a garage practicing and they realized, hey, we're getting a lot of flack for this name, Sick Man of Europe. We got to figure something out. They didn't want to be, this is a quote from him, that they didn't want to sound like Yes and all the other bands with big capes and lasers. So they came up with the word, cheap this, cheap that. And Nielsen said Cheap Trick and everyone's like, yeah, that sounds cool. And then he concedes, of course, over the next 3 years, everybody told them, you got to change that. That name's horrible, Cheap Trick.
It's a great name.
Change it to something else.
They're definitely not a laser and capes. Even their logo is even just like typewriter font. You know, it's not real.
It's the scene changes in a military movie.
U.S. warship
USSR KP travels to Argentina.
So in the
Straits of Gibraltar.
In the fall of 73, Saluga leaves because he and Nielsen weren't getting along. And that leaves the door open for Tom Peterson to join up. And then they go back to Xander. So in the summer of 74, Cheap Trick is Rick Nielsen, Tom Peterson, Bunny Carlos, and that Zeno guy.
Okay.
But trouble's brewing because according to Bunny Carlos, Tom Peterson can't stand Zeno. They hate each other. So they start thinking, well, we need a different singer. And one night they're in Minneapolis and they see they end up essentially pawning him off on a band called The Litter because this guy from The Litter comes up and says, looks like you guys aren't getting along with your lead singer. And Bunny Carlos and Nielsen look at each other and they run after him. They say, hey, are you looking for a singer? And the guy's like, well, as a matter of fact, we are. And they're like, have this guy. So that's why they end up reaching out to Robin Xander, who evidently was on his way to Colorado. And this sounds familiar. There's someone else we talked about like this. He was on his way to Colorado to start a country band or join a country band. Anyway, they get him back in the band. He's the recurring gig he had at the Wisconsin Dells ends because they'd asked him previously and he said, I can't leave. I've got this gig out there. So that ends. So he ends up joining the band and you've got the classic era lineup of Cheap Trick. Their very first gig. I love this. Their very first gig was for the Pewaukee Junior Prom.
Well, got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know what a Pewaukee is, but
it must be a town in Illinois. I'm
guessing. They end up kind of having their own version of the Hamburg thing by playing different bars and of all places, bowling alleys, which is actually where they were sort of quote unquote discovered.
Their bowling alleys are big in that part of the country. I've been to them where they act. I mean,
what was it? The '50s.
Yeah.
Everybody must have bowled. Like you on Burnett Road out here. They're from Koenig. Well, 183. Yes. There are five bowling alleys in that little stretch. So the bowling alley rock was once a big
deal. They have stages and everything at those things. And it, I guess that's just
maybe I'd bowl if they still did that.
Well, so they're playing one in suburban Milwaukee in 1976 when this guy, this producer Jack Douglas, Jack Douglas had worked with The Who and Lennon and Aerosmith.
Yeah, if I say
Aerosmith, he's visiting a relative in Waukesha. I don't know. I'm probably saying that wrong. Wisconsin. And some guy tells him to go down to the Sunset Bowl to see this band. And he walks in, and the place is packed. And then he hears the band and watches the band on stage. And you guys have talked about how they are live, and it just blew him away. So he calls Epic Records head of A&R, Tom Werman, and says, you've got to come out here and see this band. And he told him, evidently, if you don't do it, I'm going to call RCA and get RCA to sign these guys. That's how good they are.
Wow. And then they'd make singles.
So anyway, it ends up happening. They get signed to Epic. Douglas works on them on their first, on their debut in the record plant.
What was that called?
That was called Cheap Trick.
Yeah.
And it's pretty polished for, I mean, mainly because, like I said, the whole Hamburg thing, they'd played together for so long. And as I think you said, you don't have any idea how many times I've played these things, right?
Yeah. They're a band that really likes to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they repeat over and over again, well, we'd do it for free. We're just happy we're getting paid for it.
they actually recorded I Want You to Want Me, The Dream Police, and Surrender for that album. A couple other songs, I think, that made it on Heaven Tonight were recorded for the sessions. They just didn't make it. They were already working on those songs then. I believe, and I didn't double check this, but one of you guys may know, I believe the album is Side A and Side One.
That's very innovative, like left and right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, and that album leans much harder into their hard side of things, or more hard rock side of things than the pop side of stuff. It's released in 77. It sells 150,000 copies. It bubbles just above the Billboard Top 200. And let's just play a little bit of that. You never guess what that song's called.
Gary Glitter.
Hello Kitties.
When I was doing research, I went, aha, ELO.
Well, and
that's like ELO without the H.
Yeah.
Yeah.
ELO. Like yeah. The British.
Hello, Kitties.
Here's a kind of an interesting story. Before their first LPs even released, somehow the guys in Queen heard them. Really? And the first big band that they ended up, after their sign, that they end up touring with is Queen. They opened for two shows on Queen's U.S. tour that year before Thin Lizzy took over from there. Huh. We talked about this as well, how truncated their first three albums are. Right after this, they go back in the studio and they record their next album, In Color, which may be my favorite Cheap Trick
album. I think Dream Police is my favorite, but that one, I like In Color more than I like the album we're reviewing tonight.
I got a question for you guys. If I look at the album cover of In Color, mm-hmm. what do I see?
You see Robin Zander and Tom Peterson on motorcycles.
Okay. There's four members of the band.
Uh-huh. The other two guys are on the back.
I know. And if I look at Heaven Tonight, what do I see?
Robin Zander and Tom Peterson standing
in it. And the other two guys are on the back.
They're on the back, yeah.
And if I look at Live at Budokan?
Robin Zander and Tom Peterson.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So why are these two the guys that are always on the cover?
Because they're the good-looking guys. The other guys are dorky.
Because I was gonna pull this up. We don't have anybody in our organization who has same-sex attraction. But, Tony, you're a vegetarian. Those are the two attractive gentlemen in this band.
And to their credit, to the band's credit, they understand that entirely. Yeah. It's all
they joke about
cheek.
It. All, yeah. Yeah,
they know what they're doing when they do that.
I just, when I was going through the discography, I was cracking up going, okay.
In fact, I heard that people didn't take Robin Zander seriously as a vocalist because he was such eye candy. He's kind of like same problem Camus had, I guess.
That's the same problem Peter Frampton had. His fantastic guitarist that everybody thought was David Cassidy.
Well, he did look like David Cassidy. I thought you were going down the road where you're going to say, unfortunately, none of us have front cover looks.
I wasn't about to say that about me. I think you and you could be brushing your teeth and JM could be working on his tie in the back.
Well, they did change that for the Dream Police.
Dream Police, they all got to come out. That's because it kind of got fuzzy.
Tom Peterson was an athlete. Was a supposedly a really, really good baseball player.
No, I wouldn't know. Surprise me.
We'll get into
but
that later.
I think, personally, like I said, In Color is my favorite album there's, and I think it's got the single... Well, no, I shouldn't say that. That's overstatement.
So In Color is both of your favorite Cheap Trick albums.
But it's got... I want to play this song. It's got what I think is one of... Not. I was going to say the single, but that's a bit of an overstatement. But one of the best opening tracks of all time.
Oh, it's great. And that's what they open almost every time I've seen them live.
You have to open with
that. I think you open with that song and they always close with I'll Feed the Same.
Or Clock. I've heard them close with Clock Strikes 10.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that you hear that and you realize, at least to me, that's not for listening to at your house. That's for listening to at the concert.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I love listening to it at the house, I'm not saying
it's... It's wrong to listen to it at the house. It's just that has to be on the stage.
Yeah.
Well, there's also another place you could listen to it would be almost just as good.
Driving in the car with the top down.
Yeah.
Driving in the car
or with running. Top. I listened to it running the other day. I was like, yeah, this is a great.
But this is the first album that Tom Werman produces, and what he does is he takes their poppier side and leans real heavy into that. That song's a power pop song we just listened to. That album also has a studio version of I Want You to Want Me on it, which is significantly inferior to the live version. It's a great song.
It's a
still,
great song.
But he doesn't say it real slow at the beginning.
Yeah.
I want you to want me.
That's right.
There's an advantage with the Japanese audience that you're trying to communicate with.
And so that album actually hits number 73 on the Billboard charts. And then that brings us to
Heaven Tonight.
Can we talk? Can we talk briefly about the cover? Because there's a story behind that too.
Well, I don't know.
I don't know the story.
Why don't you tell us the story?
So it's in a bathroom because the record label wanted the album to be called American Standard after toilet company, plumbing company.
Why would they want that?
I don't know. Mainly because I think they were trying to market them as an American Standard. So it was a play on words. So what's interesting is that Cheap Trick changed the title, which I think is American Standard to me is better than Heaven Tonight. But they kept the picture of him in the bathroom, which I don't get. But anyway.
Well, you can tell it let the let them act out.
Yeah.
Say, you want us in the bathroom?
Okay, and I think, we'll be in the bathroom. If I remember correctly, Rick Nielsen's got a cassette copy of In Color sticking out of his back pocket.
Yeah.
Oh, he does.
Yeah.
Is that the back cover?
It is the back cover.
It's hilarious. Where he is.
That's really funny.
Well, T, I guess we're ready to go on to this record.
This was the first record ever recorded with the 12-string bass.
We do need to talk about the 12-string bass.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Jam. Why is there a 12-string bass? What's the point?
Yeah, that's a good question. So let me give you a quick brief history of it. So first of all, guys, if you ever want to just go down a rabbit hole, start doing research on the history of the bass guitar. It's pretty interesting how the bass guitar actually came into existence. But in the 60s, somebody made an 8-string bass, and it wasn't used very often, but it was used on some notable songs. Achilles' Last Ride, I think, was one. Zeppelin used them. Anyways, one of our people that we talk about quite frequently plays one, Nick Lowe. He plays it on the Rockpile albums.
The 8-string.
So the 8-string bass had been around, but supposedly it gives it a fuller sound. So it does the same thing for a bass that a 12-string guitar does for a...
The big strings don't do it for you.
The big strings are... It gives you this kind of harmony as well... An octave up, it just gives it a fuller sound.
Each string's an octave apart.
Yeah, each string is an octave apart. So, they're called courses. Now, when the 8-string came out, it wasn't always that it was an octave. In fact, I think Chris Squire of Yes tuned them to fifths. So Peterson really liked that sound, but he wanted to make it even bigger. He wanted a bigger sound. So he came, according to Rick Nielsen, he came up with the idea of the 12-string bass in like 1973.
I think that's right.
And he couldn't find anybody to really do it for him except for this small company called Hamer. I always pronounced it Hammer, but it's Hamer Guitars.
Yeah.
They did a lot of work with Cheap Trick, and they kind of...
They made Rick Nielsen's monster...
Yeah, the
six-neck guitar.
Six-neck guitar. Did that thing...
Were all the necks playable?
Yeah, he said he showed it on one of the late night shows. He actually played every one of them.
He also talked about how damn heavy it was.
Yeah,
I noticed he didn't keep it during the show very well.
So the thing with the 12-string bass is it just gives it even a fuller sound. So there's a song on Dream Police called "Gonna Raise Hell." Listen to that. That is a primo version of example of what the 12-string.
And this is Heaven Tonight's the first album with it. Title track is actually the first song.
Yeah, the first song that ever used it.
When I listen to Cheap Trick, I can barely hear the bass.
Because it's usually because he's playing it like a guitar, and it makes that sound. It makes it much more like it's like a
guitar. I hear guitar the drums at the top of the mix, the guitars in the top of the mix, sometimes the voice. But
yeah,
I don't notice that.
So I've got an odd question when you're talking about it being the way it's tuned. I read someplace that initially Hamer gave him a 10-string.
Oh,
so
really?
Would that just be a double up 5-string bass?
I guess so. Yeah, I don't know about didn't
And then and then they eventually made the 12 string for him in 77 or something like that.
So, and with the 12 string, it's you get one and then you get two octaves. So it's what they call courses. You have four courses of three strings each.
So cool. The guitar is called the Hamer Quad. That's a cool name.
Cool name.
The Hamer Quad.
Hamer Quad. But yeah, it's used on this, and it's can be really, really pretty. You can make chords with it.
Well, it's very inconvenient for people researching Cheap Trick, because you keep seeing pictures of him. And he goes, oh, he's playing a 12 string on this one.
Yeah.
You look at the neck and you go, oh, well, who's playing bass?
Well, and there are songs on this album where you can hear it. Like it sounds, you're like, ah,
that, yeah,
it's really coming through. So do you strum it?
You can strum it. You can play chord. It's much easier to make chords with, and like guitar and bass at the same time.
He says he plays it like a rhythm guitar.
Yeah,
is what he does.
Maybe that's why I don't hear it very much. I don't identify it. Well, is it time to let the folks at home hear a little bit of what we've been talking about?
Sure.
This first song, there's no chance that you're going to say this is a great way to start an album, is there, Tony?
I think that's the very first line in my notes.
Well, this first song is called Surrender, and it's a very interesting song. But we're going to talk about it after we listen to it.
It is, man, this is easily my favorite.
Do you like that song?
That song may very well be on the Mount Rushmore of power pop songs.
Easily my favorite song by them, and it is such a good song. The lyrics are bizarre to me, but...
the lyrics are great.
They are great, but they're just bizarre to me. And also, this shout out to his songwriting. This is Rick Nielsen's song. Mm-hmm. This is a fun song to listen to. It's a fun song to play. It starts off in the key of B flat, and he goes from that B flat to the A flat, then it goes to B for the first verse, then it goes to C for the last verse.
Yeah, that's one of the most important
hooks.
Not that it's about to get monotonous, but when he changes keys for the last verse, it gives it another shot in the arm that you didn't think was possible.
Yeah. So going to the lyrics real quick, I think they're worth talking about. This poor kid's getting the guy singing, the kid singing is getting a dose of, listen to your mother. You don't want to go out with those kind of girls. You know, I heard about, so-and-so's falling off the other day because there's something going around.
There was a lot of that people's privates falling off back then.
In the 70s?
No, it was earlier than that. This is a baby boomer versus a war generation.
It is, you're right.
And I know that during the 60s, if you walk down the drag, they would be all over the sidewalk.
But the funny thing
about
this poor kid is he wakes up and his parents are rolling around on the couch listening to his Kiss records. It's like, wait a minute, what happened? It sounds like
whatever happened to those losers.
It sounds like they surrendered. If you ask me. The very first, you know, the line about the wax where
that's the part that throws me.
Well, the original,
because they changed the words.
Yeah. Should we talk about that or not?
Well, we need to use the usual discretions. There's a word for females who are attracted to females that is a homonym with what the Netherlands used to protect themselves from the ocean.
Uh-huh.
That word appears,
yes.
And then when a mommy and a daddy love each other very much, but the mommy leaves town and daddy has money, sometimes he'll go see the person with the other word that didn't want to use. That's it starts with a W.
Yep.
And so.
And then the card game, Old Maids. is the other word.
Yes,
the
card game.
So,
so they had to change the words.
They changed
the old words make a lot more sense. Yeah. Even though we don't say those words,
they do. They make a lot more sense considering what he ends up, the dad ends up saying and defending her. Like, oh, she was never one of them.
Really? Can't you see him with his pipe and his newspaper sitting there? Son, you ought to listen to your mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so good.
We mentioned that 70s show where I just made that connection that the show was essentially about the songs.
There's something that the parents are doing. They're rolling numbers. a lot of people don't understand what that is.
I don't understand what that is.
Well, a lot of people think it has something to do with the devil's weed.
That's what I thought it was.
But I did research, and I have something here for y'all.
Team, good as gold. Let me see your fingers roll the fours. Wearmore Hall, are you ready for more? Now this is how we roll our fours. 4, 8, 12, 16, 20, 24. This is how we roll our fours. Let's give them some more. 28, 32, 36, 40, 44, 48. This is how we roll our fours. La, 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 la. Boo!
So you're telling me
the parents are doing times tables.
The Greatest Generation enjoy, put their Kiss records on and does time tables.
I looked up rolling numbers, and that's what I found.
I figured they were messing around on the couch and getting into the bag of doobage. You know,
found the Kiss stash.
I'm certainly fine. Boys like Cheap Trick would not do that. And their parents, I'm sure, were doing.
Well, enough. here's a kind of a really interesting story about them. They never performed inebriated at all. They would get liquored up to no end after the shows, but they're the rule. Huh. We don't play drunk.
That's a good rule.
Yeah.
And probably it means less afterwards too, because you're tired.
Yeah. Jam, we have to talk about the Bottle Rocket story when we talk about Surrender.
Oh yeah, that was a great episode. One of my favorite memories of South by Southwest, and one of the funniest things I've ever witnessed in my life.
So Jam and I go see the Bottle Rockets at Yard Dog, at a Yard Dog show, and they're having trouble with their bass amp. The bass amp isn't working, right?
Yeah, right. And the stage is real rickety.
Yeah.
So they have to get a new head for the amp. Somebody gives it. I can't remember who gives it to them, but it doesn't quite fit on top of the cabinet for the...
Right.
So... And they're trying to put it up on top of the cabinet. Yeah. And the whole time, the lead singer, guitarist,
Brian Henneman,
he's just making these incredibly funny comments.
And so when they finally get the bass amp to work, he leans into the mic and says, well, there's no other song to play but this one. And they go straight into playing Surrender, which I'd never heard them play before, but it was awesome.
Oh,
it was perfect.
Perfect.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of known for doing Cheap Trick covers, aren't they?
I think occasionally, yeah. So that single hit number 62 on the Hot 100 and number 83 on the U.S. Cashbox Top 100.
How that song just didn't skyrocket to number one.
Well, think about when it was released. It's 1977. I mean, this kind of music, you know, wasn't...
It was disco and punk.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as much as people want to talk about Cheap Trick being punky, they're not.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't... Nothing.
Yeah.
I don't know why
loud.
They say that.
I guess they're loud. That's it. It's weird.
They don't even have the right haircuts. I understand sometimes when people get confused by appearances, but they don't even have that excuse here.
Yeah.
Right.
So it makes no sense to me. I remember bumping into that. Maybe it was Dave Marsh and Rolling Stone saying, I said, shut up.
Well, and they're not, you know, not to beat a continuing thing that we talk about with American punk. Cheap Trick wasn't going, oh, the music today stinks, so I want to go back to what we had. This is just what they were creating.
This is
what they were doing, you know? Yeah,
they weren't responding to that.
Yeah. So if there's I've talked about this show before, this podcast before called Sound Explorer.
Uh-huh.
And there's an episode with Surrender where Rick Nielsen talks about writing Surrender and how they were producing it and all that stuff. Apparently, there was a lot more keyboards on it. The producer just layered it, and that Jai Wingding guy was just playing keyboards all over the place. Supposedly, Rick Nielsen said, we can't have that many. Crank up the guitars, pull the keyboards down.
So you really, the only time you hear the keyboards is like at the beginning, like
that kind of orchestrated, almost violin, cello-y sound that comes in.
Yeah,
I think the producer hits the right mix of their harder edge stuff and their popular stuff on this album.
He's really good at the drums and guitars.
Yeah,
it's interesting to me that there's no lead, really, no lead guitar busting in.
Well, he's not really.
He doesn't do that very much.
He doesn't play lead very often.
He likes riffs.
Yeah.
He's a riff guy.
And when you see
him... pig dragging.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of.
Ah.
Yeah.
Speaking
of. Are we ready to go to the next
one? Oh, yeah.
Okay. That song's called You're on Top of the World.
Yep. And it has the longest pick scrape in recorded history, I'm pretty sure. That
whole you can hear the 12-string bass on this song.
Yeah, you can.
Definitely.
You really can.
Yeah, they got that weird kind of Peter Gunn intro going on before they kick into the song.
Yeah. That's an example of what I'm talking about. Like, you have no idea where the song's going to go. Yeah.
I love that song.
It's a good song.
It's a really good song. A lot of bands wouldn't have a singer that could pull that off.
Oh, he's perfect.
He's perfect.
Absolutely perfect.
It makes it sound like it's easy to sing that way.
And at the end of the chorus, the dun, 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 that descending guitar riff, that has been copied by so many power pop bands after this album came out.
I mean, including Cheap Trick,
You hear it everywhere.
Yeah,
you do. You know? It's like this punctuation.
Oh, the drums are incredible.
It's hard for me not to say this is my favorite song on the album because only because I've heard Surrender so many times.
Yeah,
this song comes on and I immediately hit repeat and listen to it again. It's so great.
You know, a theme with Cheap Trick Dream, which surprises me because he's not really in the band anymore, is like they give Bunny Carlo, like, he starts off a lot of songs. They give him breaks in a lot of songs.
He occupies the space a lead guitarist would normally.
Yeah, he really
occupy.
Does.
Now, he's a great drummer.
He is. He's right on beat. Every time I've seen him, he never misses a beat.
Identifiable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He may be the most identifiable musician in the band.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
All right. Well, the album doesn't end there, ladies and gentlemen. We have a little number. I think this is written by somebody else, T.
A guy by the name of Roy Wood from
Roy
The
Wood.
Move.
The California Man.
Going to a party. Meet me on after school.
That sounds like rock and roll to me.
This is better than the Move version. It really is. It's just more concise and more.
It's a lot of energy.
I love the Move version. That was the last song the last thing they did as a band before they morphed into ELO. But the one thing I want to talk about in this is such an homage to that band that they actually, right in the middle of the song, they play the guitar riff from Brontosaurus. So yeah, they in the middle of like the bridge part of
California Man,
Cheap Trick slides into that Brontosaurus groove.
That is so cool.
Yeah, and that was being that California Man was the last single the Move did. That Brontosaurus was the first single that had Jeff Lynne on it before he ruined the band.
I'm joking.
I must have really hurt Tony when I talked about his keyboard bells.
But yeah, you can really, on that riff in the song, you can really, that 12 string comes in, that 12 string bass comes in. And
I wonder if that 12 string gives them a little bit of that
Wallace Sound stuff I hear on Surrender and other songs like that.
But the band maybe sounds tighter on this song than any other song on the album. They sound just so like firing on all cylinders. Yeah. It's just this little concise punch of rock and roll.
Yeah, they've probably played it
a gazillion times.
Too, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you're going to be a California man, you got to be a high roller, see? Next song is High Roller.
Interesting song. I mean, another one where it starts off one place and it becomes totally poppy.
I think this song epitomizes that Cheap Trick straddling, though, because it starts off as a mid 70s hard rocker.
That's this is one of the songs that made me think of AC/DC.
Yeah,
some of that stuff.
It's not particularly interesting, but Lord have mercy when the chorus kicks in.
Yeah.
It is so hook filled.
Yeah.
It makes me, if that wasn't there, I probably wouldn't like the song. No, but every like time I'm thinking, that chorus kicks in, and I'm just I love
it. They do that a lot.
Yeah.
So they rescue their songs.
They do rescue their songs.
Well, it reminds me of what I said about Lucinda Williams. I mean, okay, here we go.
Yeah.
This gal, she's a waitress. Okay. And then here comes a chorus that really pulls me in.
Yeah, no, this song does that, and it's kind of an interesting little snapshot of how they work in that world, you know?
The next song is called
Alphidazin.
This is, they show off their polyglot skills on this song. They say goodbye in a bunch of different languages.
Yeah.
This may be, just going back to the punk thing, this may be the most punk song in the sense of attitude, because it's so irreverent. It's a song about suicide, and it's so irreverent about that subject.
Yeah.
It's just basically almost thumbing their nose at anybody sort of considering that route, you know?
Yeah, I find it a fascinating song. I love how it just starts off with just the bass and guitar, mm-hmm. and just making, you know, and then those, you know, the drums come in and just making all that weird sound, and the drums come in and just takes you.
And it may be the blueprint, Doug, for one of those songs where the magic or the music doesn't match the subject matter, you know, because but again, they're irreverent talk. It's very strange. There's like, okay, you're thinking about doing yourself in. Well, sayonara.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Auf Wiedersehen.
This is officially Doug Cooper's least favorite song on the album.
Why is that?
Because of subject matter?
I don't care about what he's saying about it. And there's none of the carefree fun that the other songs have that attract me to Cheap Trick in the first place. So,
well, it is the most cynical song. And
maybe that's it. I don't think Cheap Trick and cynical go well together.
But the thing, I like this song a lot, and the thing I also find very attractive about it is when the chorus kicks in and Robin Zander does his best glam rock vocal, that kind of, you know, it's, I don't know what he's doing, but it's great.
I don't like it because I don't like songs I can't pronounce the name of. So I object to having to use Google pronunciation.
Well, Chicago's got a big Polish and German population. I mean, didn't they play like Sausage Fest or something like that? I'm not kidding.
Another tagline for the podcast.
I think for the sake of our audience at home,
Sausage Fest.
Inexperienced jams had a Sausage Fest should be withheld from a broadcast. We got a lot of Germans here, JM.
Well, that's true, but
that's why we have all these Ruggenschnacker towns all around.
This is a song that has the Dylan line in it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The line
many here among us who think love is but a joke.
Yeah, the direct
that
quote
was not really Bob Dylan, ladies and gentlemen.
I thought he was here.
Jeez.
Somebody covered that song too. So, I can't remember.
What I'm going to say is not going to probably you're probably not going to agree with this because you don't like the song, but I think this is a fantastic way to close this out, this side of the album out. It's,
yeah.
I mean, I get it. I get what you're saying, though. It's the cynicism is a little. It stands out some.
I just see him with his going with his little lid, his hat, his visor hat flipped up, going funny. I'm being funny. Yeah. So that irritates me. It irritates me when I do it.
You know, there's an Anthrax cover of this song.
That sounds appropriate.
I've heard other people cover this song.
Yeah, there's a couple of people. I think some band out of the Deep Ellum era, Dallas stuff, covers it too. I can't remember who it is. But
well, ladies and gentlemen, as T mentioned, this is a flippage. We are flipping over to side two. And the song is Taking Me Back.
Can you say ELO?
That's what I was trying to do in sign language.
Yeah, it's definitely an ELO-y song. This is another song where it sounds very, it's not that poppy. It's very much more sort of straightforward. But with the ELO elements, obviously adding the pop element to it. And it's also, you know, you were talking about Surrender being keyboard heavy. This song's pretty keyboard heavy, too. It is
pretty keyboard heavy.
I like this song a lot.
This is probably my second favorite song.
And I may be liking it from association with ELO. I have to confess, my love for that sound is so deep that anyone imitating it, and I think something has to be said that both Cheap Trick and ELO are leaning so heavily on the Beatles,
right,
that sometimes we may be confusing influence of ELO with influence of the Beatles.
Right.
But there's a sound.
On this song, I don't think that's the case.
When you play that other song earlier, there's a sound that's definitely, it's that Beatles via whatever Jeff Lynne does to the Beatles.
Yeah, he does that. Yeah.
It's funny. You'll never guess what the last line of my notes say.
What's that?
Not one of my favorite songs.
Really? This is my second. I love it, man. I mean, the harmonies are great.
Now, that's a caveat. I like this song a lot, but there's songs I elevate above it.
You like the whole album so much.
And I don't know if it's because of that element to it or not. I think it's just the things I lean into more, the more straightforward power poppy stuff.
I thought the things you didn't like about ELO was his insistence on having strings everywhere.
Well, no, it's that. It's not the ELO isn't the reason I dislike this song.
No, I'm not shouldn't talking say about this song. I'm talking about in general the thing that
it is. It is. Well, it's also the embracing of disco as well.
Anyway, well, I think it really showcases Xander's vocals because he does so many different things on this song that he starts off just, you know, kind of just in the lower register, and then he just starts belting it.
He is a very underrated vocalist.
Oh, he is. He really, really is.
I wonder if he had some hardship in his life and had a shorter haircut and wasn't pretty. I wonder.
Yeah, I'm not sure
if he would have branched out and did this remarkable album reflecting on the.
You're kind of talking in a way like the critics didn't. The critics like this band. I think part of the problem was, you know, people like to pigeonhole bands, and this is a difficult band to do that with. And I think also, they were their own worst enemies when Tom Petersen left and they went in that kind of lull of not making very good albums after that. And then when he came back and they, of course I say wasn't, but the flame was huge, but anyway, not the greatest song in the world.
No.
Anyway, I like that one quite a bit. And up next we have another song on the radio. One of those great songs about people who fall in love with radio.
It's a
one of my favorite albums. Moving Pictures had a song like this on it.
Was it Moving Pictures? That was Permanent Waves.
Sorry. One of those Keebler albums.
It's what the
This is a well-trod subject in rock, isn't it?
But it does.
No, I think that if you're going to put an album out, you need to say something about the DJ.
Yeah.
Because that's who's going to play it. So you might say something nice about the DJ.
Unlike Elvis Costello, who at the same time decided he wanted to give the middle finger to radio.
Yeah. Who's the DJ on this?
I don't know. That's a good idea. We should have looked it up.
Oh, that's another connection.
Is it?
It is.
Think about other albums with a rapidly talking DJ inserted into the song. Not a DJ.
He's a sportscaster.
Paradise by the Dashboard Light with Meatloaf.
Yeah.
They're very similar in that rapid speaking. And I think it works and I enjoy it.
I think it works really well.
I have a really romantic idea about radio.
I do too.
And I do too.
I love the idea of you get your DJ and he's introducing music to you. But the problem is it doesn't exist anywhere.
No.
Sirius.
The
Underground Garage.
Underground Garage. It's better than it's ever been before.
Yeah.
But I still like that idea.
But guys our age have, had that relationship. Just like guys.
Oz in KLBJ FM.
Yeah, guys, earlier than that, I was talking to somebody the other day about the station I grew up with, the Zoo in Dallas, and what a great station that was.
A great station.
And there were disc jockeys on there that you had an affinity for, They were your guys.
You could spend a whole day, like 12 hours working on something, listening to your radio station, and it would make the work easy and light. I don't know. I feel so sorry for kids. They don't know the.
Mm-mm. They don't have. They don't personal know about connection
diving into an album. They don't know about getting a radio station where you know.
Yep.
It's just they go. Oh, I'm gonna get my phone out and stare at myself, and then I'm gonna pick a song I want to hear.
Yeah.
I can remember just aching to hear a song, and can you remember getting a cassette player and you've got the record and play button down and the pause is down and you're waiting for the song to come on and all you have to do is hit the pause and it will record it.
I remember when a new album would come out and the single was going to be and they would you'd know when the single was going to be played and you or within the hour we're going to play the new single by so and so
and you'd sit there and
listen to it wait to record it.
Well, I grew up in Mason and San Angelo, but even I remember when San Angelo would on I think it was Saturday nights at 10, would play a whole album. It would just say, we're going to be playing this whole album. So I'd get my cassette player out, and I'd hope to God I had enough tape on.
Well, anyway, all you young people who don't listen to this show, y'all know what your problem is. You don't have radio stations that you like anymore. Yeah. Well, and they had independence. That's what I really liked.
Yeah.
Is that they weren't playing whatever was coming down from some programmer in New York City or something like
that. Right, yeah. But going back to the song.
Oh, yeah, we're talking about Cheap Trick tonight.
this song's great. It's so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
There are hand claps in it.
There are hand claps.
Which I love. You know that.
I didn't know that, Tom.
It's got the great little that ascending guitar line, which I think the bass actually doubles in a few spots as well.
Talking about that kind of love affair with radio, one of my favorite lines in the song is when he says, "Hey, mister on the radio, please play my favorite song, the one where she doesn't go away." That's such a great line.
That's a great line. You know? He does write some great lines.
And this feels like a 60s pop song to me.
It does.
It does.
It's out of time.
Yeah.
All right.
And I love, just real quick, I love that electric piano at the end.
Oh, it's got that. Oh, yeah.
That's
a little out of time.
That Wurlitzer. Yeah.
It starts with when the DJ comes in and then he kicks off and it just kind of fades the song out. It's really great.
Yeah. They let Jai go to town on that.
Well, that's not the end of the album, ladies and gentlemen.
Nope.
There is a track number 8 called Heaven Tonight, which may sound familiar to some of y'all. Would you like to go? I got a nickname for this song.
What's that?
Double F.
What's that?
Fast Forward. I hate this song.
I don't hate it.
I don't hate it. It's not your usual heaven themed song, let's put it.
Well, it's an anti-drug song.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, because
maybe that's why I hate it.
And it's got that double entendre about heaven.
Yeah, do you where wanna, but you heaven, can't you come go down.
To heaven by getting high, but it can also kill you and send you to heaven. Yeah. So I think that's what's going on there. People talk about this song in the same breath that they talk about like psychedelic Beatles songs. They say, "Oh, it's reminiscent of Strawberry Fields or I'm the Walrus." I don't get that. Other than maybe it's Xander. He sounds more Lennon-y on this song than any other song.
He does sound double-tracked. And
what is and, voice sounds weak on this song, yeah. like Lennon yeah. did at the end of the Beatles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, Nielsen said there's kind of an intentional making fun of 60s drug songs musically on this. So maybe
it does. To me, it sounds like he's making fun of the song, and he also sounds like he's making fun of people who are taking him seriously.
Yeah, maybe. The one thing I don't. So he plays a mandocello on that? Yeah. I don't know what a mandocello is.
Mandocello is like a mandolin. So a mandolin is tuned like a violin.
And a mandocello is
tuned like a cello. And a mandocello is tuned like a cello. So mandolin has 8 strings. Again, we're talking about the courses, but they're tuned the same. Mandocello is the same.
Is it bigger?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Bigger. Which one would John Wayne play?
He probably played the mandocello.
Oh, hell yeah, he would.
They're fine. Yeah,
that's a good one. All right, boy.
There's also a harpsichord on this song.
Is that, yeah? Yeah, I can hear that. And that's played by Rick Nielsen, isn't it?
Maybe, yeah. I think he does. He plays both. This isn't, I don't hate this song, but I get it. It's what we were talking about earlier. When they try to do something like this, it's very difficult for them to pull it off.
Right.
What you said about Lennon and trying to be the psychedelic Beatles, I believe that. I think I hear them trying to do that. But they don't do anything interesting.
Yeah.
There's no backtracking. Mm-mm. There's no, let me take you down. There's no mushrooms.
Yeah. There's no break, really, either.
It's monotonous.
Yeah.
It is monotonous.
It's got that dirge drum beat.
It stands out like a sore thumb on this album.
It does.
It does.
Because you got all this energy, and here you go.
Whoa. The sucks all the air.
Thank God. Thank God there's the next song.
And then, okay, that's right. This next song, ladies and gentlemen, is called Rock and Roll. The next song is called Stiff Competition. Question about what part of the clip I was going to play. I absolutely have to have that opening.
That guitar riff is so good.
Good luck getting that out of your head after you hear it.
Yeah.
You know what it's based on?
No.
Won't Get Fooled Again.
I can see that.
Yeah. It's so great.
I love how it kind of goes away for a little while and then it starts coming back in. Oh, the bass. This is my favorite guitar part, bass part.
That reminds me of what he's... As far as guitar playing, I think that's what he's best at, right?
He really is.
And what kind of guitar do you have? Is that a Gibson playing it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a Les Paul.
And the drums on this song are remarkable as well. Yeah.
But this is another one that sounds cobbled together to me.
Oh, not to me. I love this song.
Oh, I'm not saying it's not necessarily a knock on it, but it's by this time I'm like, okay, well, we're going to go someplace different. And sure enough, we go someplace different.
I wish since this is a family broadcast, I can't say what he said the song should be called, but it's pretty funny. This song is so sophomorically dumb lyrically, but I love it. It's just great.
Well, that's their strength is they've never set themselves up as anything else, and they don't have to put on airs. They don't have to.
I think in the 80s, they may have tried. Somebody may have. Tried to move them in a more.
Well, we don't have to deal with that tonight.
Nope. We're in heaven tonight.
We're in heaven tonight, baby. Yep. And right after that song, there is another song. And this song is called How Are You?
How Are You?
Great after I hear this one.
chorus cool, is so great. Cool, cool guitar noises he's
great
making.
Great guitar noises. It almost starts off like you think it's going to be a Billy Joel song, and then it turns
into that. It sounds to me like ELO sounding like the Kinks.
No, this is I think it's McCartney-esque and ELO. I think this is ELO. The thing I don't like about
good morning, ELO, day's ties for blue sky.
He strips the strings out of it, and ELO's like this. It's great. This song and On Top of the World are sort of the sandwich of power pop to me.
Yeah.
You got the real hard-edged, rocky stuff, and then you got this bounce. I am a sucker for bouncy bananas.
Yeah, that's such
I love
great,
that stuff.
That Gerald.
And oh, it's so great.
Sun is shining. Somebody should do a YouTube video.
And the other thing is
all the songs that start that way.
I think you were doing this. This is essentially a more sophisticated version of I Want You to Want Me.
Yeah.
It's essentially that song, but just fleshed out more. You know?
But the vocals. This is another one that really, I think this is Xander's best vocal performance probably ever.
This is another song that I struggle with not saying was my favorite song on the album. It's just so fun and just makes you feel so good.
It's got a nice sing-along chorus.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's also got, it's got the Our Father in it. Did you know that?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yeah,
that's what Catholics call the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah, I was not going to call it the Lord's Prayer. I'm a papist,
we call it the prayer of Jesus in our church.
You probably call it the prayer of her.
But there's that section in where it's where he talks about my friend, what's with you or whatever, that part of the song, and then there's like this real fast sort of thing.
Yeah,
that's the Our Father. Recorded it.
I read about 1/8
speed, and then when they play it through the song, it sped up 8 times faster than you normally would hear. I guess technically this is the last song. Technically, it's the last song
on the record on the vinyl version of it.
Yeah. Then there's that hidden track, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is
I don't have
like half of it is the drums, and then it just. What's the one line that's in it?
Konnichiwa.
Oh, Konnichiwa. Yeah, that's all.
It's Eau Claire is the name of it, and it's a knock on the, or a spoof on the town of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where they played a lot when they were.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a.
It's a beautiful city, by the way. I've been there.
Well, I just think.
Why don't you go there?
Going back to How Are
You.
Texas. Going back to How Are You, how great is that to end a song or end an album with that song?
Pretty good.
It puts you in there. You're just ready to start your day.
Yep.
Yeah, it kind of makes you want to start over.
Yep.
Yeah, it does. It really
and
does.
Boy, you start over and Surrender kicks in. It's like, is that ever? Do you ever do that? Flip this over, put that on, and think, oh, that was a bad idea.
So yeah, I was listening to it in the car or driving to Colorado, and for some reason, I stopped the car at How Are You and got back in the car, and then. They went through the rest of How Are You in Eau Claire, and then
Surrender
drive back in to Surrender. I was like, okay, I'm not turning this off.
Yeah, it's hard. Surrender's a hard song to turn off.
It's a hard song to turn off.
Surrender Interruptus is what I call that.
This is one of the albums that, like I said, it's not my favorite one of theirs, but it's...
you can see why people talk about this album the way they do.
Yeah, I really do. And it's kind of where they start becoming.
From my research, it seemed like this is the most highly reviewed of their records.
It is.
I don't know that... Budokan's my favorite because...
Well, it's the greatest hits, sort of,
Well,
like any live
there's
album is.
Something weird about all those Japanese girls screaming at the top of their lungs. And you can tell the band's responding. And again, I think... These guys are made to be live, and they're not the Beatles wrapped up in themselves in the studio. They need that input from the audience. But
and this is the album where I think you can kind of see where they're going, because you've got some of the string arrangements going on. It seems like the production is getting a little bit more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
There seems like they're a little bit more comfortable in the studio. I guess the album after this was Budokan, right?
They
kind of stomped on this one. I think I'm sure it helped sales, but it's like this was almost
it was like
watching Mercury after the sun comes up. It's just Budokan just blew everything out. I mean, I can remember they would not quit
Oh, it played ain't that a even shame. In, yeah, even in San Angelo, it was Surrender, they, Ain't That a Shame.
They would play that triad over and over again. And
yeah.
They just, and then if you, do, like, I bet the skull and the roller skating things were filled with it.
Do you guys remember that Diet Coke ad from the early 2000s where this girl is watching this guy get ready across, it's in a high rise, and she's watching this guy get ready in a high rise across from her, and she's talking about how he's kind of dorky or whatever, but he knows, her words are, but he knows the words to the greatest rock and roll song ever, and he's singing, I Want You to Want Me. And I always thought, if I wasn't married, that's the kind of woman I would go after right there.
Are you saying Lindsay's not that way?
Lindsay is that way. Look, God bless her. She's a wonderful lady, and she loves that song as well as the band. So I'm okay with that.
She is doing yeoman's work,
dealing with me.
I didn't mean to say it that way. Did it sound like that way to you, J.O.?
But well, the version of "I Want You to Want Me" on Budokan is just the guitar playing alone on that is just.
The balance phenomenal. Between the crowd noise and the band is perfect.
And he goes.
It makes that version makes it sound like it's the greatest song ever recorded.
Yeah,
it does. It does,
and then that the whole world's there to confirm it. Mm-hmm. It's up there with The Last Waltz and some of the other great live albums of all times.
Yeah,
I knew we'd get back to it because that's my baby.
Well, and the album that
and
came
there's no
up,
fat on it.
Yeah, no,
They just song to song.
And the album that came after that is Dream Police, which is the one that I really, really like.
I like Dream Police a lot,
too. It's a great album.
Yeah, it's got Voices on it. It's got Dream Police on
that,
it.
That you talk about wall of sound, that Dream Police wall of sound is just irresistible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the last one they did with the Tom Werman guy, or what's his name?
It is. Yeah. And I can't remember when Tom Patterson left.
He left after the next one all shook down.
Okay.
And you know why he left?
Uh-uh.
I just found this out today. To play baseball.
Oh.
He was trying to be a minor. He thought his time to try to be a professional baseball player was going away. So he played minor league baseball for a good while and played in a band with his wife on the side when the season was off. But yeah, he had a fairly successful.
So he was gone, and then he comes back and joins the band just in time for them to release The Flame, right, or record The Flame.
Yeah, there was a period where there's a couple of songs by them that I like when Tom Peterson is gone. One of the albums is produced by Roy Thomas Baker.
Oh wow, there's a connection.
Yeah, it's got that. It's the one that she's that you know, give me, but there's a lot of really good, like just kind of power pop songs. But that's also when they started getting into writing with other guys. And so, but then there's an album that comes after that that's produced by Todd Rundgren that's got a song that's actually written by Robin Zander, which is one of my favorite Cheap Trick songs. It might be my second or third favorite Cheap Trick song. I Can't Take It. Really cool chord progression, but it's a great song. It's got pretty cool.
That sounded like not Cheap Trick until it got
the chorus. Well, I have, I kind of like everything. You kind of stop listening to bands or whatever when they're not doing things that necessarily are in your wheelhouse. But when listening to this, I sort of started digging into Cheap Trick and found that Rockford album, which came out in the 2000s or something. It's just great.
I like that, and I like whatever's going on in the background with that drum and stuff. That was good.
Yeah.
So anyway, these guys, they all died in a plane crash.
Well, no, because that came out in 2006.
Yeah. Oh,
but you still can die in a plane crash between now and then.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, they didn't like die in a plane crash, ladies and gentlemen. I was just trying to wrap up the show.
They had a pretty long, they've got a lot of albums.
But they never got up here again.
I don't think they did.
No, they kind of, like I said, they kind of shot themselves in the foot a little bit.
They started working, like we were saying earlier, they started working with other writers. They really tried to get their, the sheen was kind of gone. They had this over 80s production.
Well, they did.
They're one of those bands that can't move to the next thing.
They're like the Ramones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't have the next thing.
And people try to push them in that direction, and they lose sight of what made them so great.
Yeah.
And they start, yeah. And then they've got to return to that in order to get people interested again, which I as a musician, I would think that's kind of tiring. You want to try new stuff and do and whatever.
I think you got to have a long career. And you look at anybody who's had a really long career, and it's been this stage. Yeah. I mean, look at Springsteen's last album versus... Greetings from Asbury Park. There's nothing.
Nick Lowe.
Yeah.
Look at Nick Lowe today versus, you know.
Nothing in common with where they started.
Yeah.
Or Paul Simon.
Yeah.
I don't think you can keep just grinding out the same deal. You need a producer to come in. Or like Johnny Cash had his producer come in and say, let's strip this whole thing down to you and your big thumb guitar. So, ladies and gentlemen, generally, we'd like to give two reviews to this album. Or all of our albums. We have a critic review where we pretend like we're real critics and say we try to sound like we're on national pretentious radio and say what we think. And then we give a personal rating where we let our emotions ooze out all over the place. And that way we can separate and be honest with our feelings and honest with our thinking. Jonathan J.M. Rowe, you're a very sensitive person. Could you tell us about your review of this record, Heaven Tonight, by Cheap Trick?
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and give it my critic's rating first. It's 4-0 as a critic. It is really, really good for what it is. I just think there's better representations of Cheap Trick. I think Live at Budokan is... If they could have grabbed a little bit more of that element, their live, what they do so well live. And, you know, I think the playing is good. I think Robin Zander's voice is amazing. I think the songwriting is 90% of the time right on. But like I was saying earlier, it seems like the album just is not totally baked. So I'm going to give it a 4-0. Personally, this is tough because every time, this is another one where it kept getting better every time I listened to it. And I said at the beginning of the show that I have a hard time getting through a whole Cheap Trick album. And I think that still is the case here. I think the song, the Heaven Tonight song is definitely a downer. I think that the second half of the album is much better than the first half besides the Heaven Tonight song. So my personal rating is going to be like a 3-8, but that could possibly go up to something higher. I mean, Surrender is one of the greatest songs I think ever written. How Are You? I think it's just a phenomenal song. So like I said, 3-8 personally.
Thank you, Jonathan J.M. Rowe. I'm going to go next because this is closer to a T pick than it is to a D pick. I enjoyed this record a lot. This record, if you think about an archery target, there's the black, the red, the yellow, and then I think there's something else out of it. This is the yellow for Doug Cooper's interest in rock and roll. I have an interest in it, but it's not one of the target in the center interest. So it that limits how far it can get into me. But as a critic, I think I can be a critic on this one because I'm not emotionally attached at all. This is a 4-5, maybe higher than that. I don't know, but that's where I'm gonna go. My individual pick, how often I listen to it, what I like about it, and that's a 4-0. So these guys are really good at what they do.
And whenever they stay on what they do, they're unbeatable. And if they come to town, I'm going to go see them. And I will listen to this record again, and I will listen to my other Cheap Trick albums again, especially live at Budokan. T.
Yeah, Doug.
This is your territory. Tell us where it lies.
It's hard for me to distinguish critic versus personal, so I'm going to just double down and say it's a 4.7 for both for me. JM saying that, you know, it's, I forget what you said initially, something like, you know, that the, you know, it's good for what it is. Well, for what it is, I love. Yeah. This is my stuff, you know? And it's right in my wheelhouse. You did talk about the, you know, kind of the, even though I don't consider this metal, the harder guitars and the melodic aspect of the power poppiness of this really speaks to me. So yeah, 4.7 for both for me is no brainer. The only reason it's not a 5 is Heaven Tonight brings it down. I don't hate that song, but it definitely brings it down. And there's a couple of other moments that just don't, they're not as good as the rest of the album. So it just knocks down a slightly.
Yeah. And there are plenty of others out there who give this a 5.
Well, and I'm not going to knock anybody for giving it a 5.
And I think I won't. One of the things that we do that the other people can't do is we can land in between 4.5 and 5,
yeah.
Which gives us some precision. Ladies and gentlemen, you will not find that precision on other podcasts.
That's right.
At this time, we always turn to our youngster who is
by a matter of minutes.
Who's hip with what the kids are all about these days. So smash that like button. Power Pop T, what do you have for us tonight?
Well, I hope everybody is okay with me leaning towards Austin bands, just because I feel like we're an Austin podcast and it's good to give people, some local musicians, some shouts. The band I'm going to talk about is a band called Peach Fuzz. They're actually started in LA, but they moved, the lead singer moved to Austin several years ago, and they've released 4 or 5 albums, a couple of singles. I happened upon them. I went to ABGB's to see a band, and they were playing with that band, and I walked in and I leaned over to Lindsay and I said, "Oh my God, this is a power pop band." I mean, it's, and the reason I'm picking him for tonight, I think will be abundantly clear. I'm going to play the title track off of their 2017 album On Pop of the World. Do you wanna make- Okay, that's the title track, and I'm going to play
that
one
more. That sounds pretty good.
I like that.
I'm going to play one more song.
That sounds like an album T would like.
Yeah. And one more song. I'm going to play a song called Hey, 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 Henrietta. Can imagine me walking into the bar and getting ready to see a band, and that comes out of the amps.
Yeah. I bet Lindsay was ready for you to just settle down and let her listen to the music. They should send Henrietta to the Monkees. I think that's perfect.
Yeah, no, it's a good band, and that album in particular is a little more sort of on the sweeter side of power pop. They do some stuff that sounds straight out of the Cheap Book. Or Cheap Trick playbook.
Yeah.
It's Peach Fuzz. That album's called On Pop of the World 2017. There'll be a link to the Bandcamp link on our website. Check it out. If you like what you heard, check it out. They're well worth listening to.
All right. Thanks for that, T. Thanks for letting us know about another great band out of the Austin, Texas area. And thank you, dear listener, for letting us fill your airwaves with yet another episode of This Is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. If you know anyone who likes the long player format, please let them know about this podcast. And we're available on most podcasting platforms. And while you're on one of those podcasting platforms, please leave us a review. Leave us some stars. We'd love to hear from you. We're always looking for feedback. You also can reach us via Twitter at Tapping Vinyl. And you can visit our Facebook group page if you're so inclined. And also, if you're old school, you can email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But of course, for the ultimate This Is Vinyl Tap experience, visit our website that is maintained by our very own Tony Slagle. You're going to find links to all our past episodes, information about the bands that we've talked about, links to videos, links to articles, rare pictures. You can also contact us there as well and leave us a review. Let us know what you would like for us to review in an upcoming episode as well. Next week, we'll be looking at an album by one of the more overlooked bands of the 60s and early 70s, 10 years after, and perhaps their biggest album, A Space and Time from 1971. Everywhere is freaks and Harris, Dykes and Ferris. Tell me where is sanity? For our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe, this is Vinyl Tap.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Let's give them some more. 28, 32, 36, 40, 44, 48. This is how we roll our fours. La, 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 la.
Remember there, reading about
it. Well, I got a computer that repeats that prayer for my benefit like 36,000 times a minute every day. So definitely going to benefit from that. There's a guy that did that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he had this prayer on a computer and sped it up and put it on constant loop so that he could get the benefit of prayer.
Rather than doing it himself. Himself,
yeah. Well, it's not efficient. It's much more efficient to outsource that.
Yeah.
But